Good afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darton, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, the documentary Wood Street about the West Oakland encampment has been selling out at film festivals. I chat with filmmaker Karen Creighton and longtime Wood Street resident and organizer John Donasco. Then we revisit my conversation with Andrew Durham, the director of the film Fairyland, which is an adaptation of a true story about a father and daughter that takes place in San Francisco in the 70s and during the early days of the AIDS epidemic. Today's show is about Bay Area filmmakers keeping it real. That's all coming up. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darton, on KALW 91.7 FM. A new documentary has been selling out theaters at Bay Area film festivals. It's called Wood Street, and the film chronicles events at the West Oakland encampment leading up to the city shutting it down. Hundreds of unhoused people lived in Wood Street over the decade of its existence, making it one of the largest homeless encampments in Northern California. The documentary humanizes the residents by showing Wood Street as more than an encampment, but a community. And here's a clip from the movie trailer.
You can't evict 1,000 people and only have 100 shelter beds for them to go. And then the following week, go back and evict them again with no place for them to go and continue on doing this.
Who has the power here on this site right now? Who's telling everybody what to do? Can I talk to that person? Huh?
Where's the water?
Wood Street will be screening at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland on Wednesday, July 15th. And joining me is John Janosco. He was one of the key organizers of Wood Street Residents and very, very vocal against the eviction of the encampment. And Karen Creighton is a documentarian and award-winning journalist. And she's back on the Sights and Sounds Show. I interviewed her several weeks ago. So I'm so happy you all are here. Welcome, Karen and John.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah. So before we even just dive into this interview, I just want to share some data that according to the Alameda County Housing and Health Department, there are about 4,416 people unhoused in Oakland and Piedmont. Now, this is down nearly 20% from 2 years ago. Karen, this was is such a powerful film. I learned so much from this film. What led to you even doing this story?
Yeah, I was working as a journalist, mostly doing podcasts for the San Francisco Chronicle back in 2021 and 2022. And I, you know, reported a few stories on Wood Street from a couple different angles. And in the summer of 2022, when they got their eviction notices from the state of California, I saw the community basically, you know, hiring lawyers and taking the state to court under the highway overpass, like on Zoom meetings. And I was just so, you know, I thought it was so powerful. And so at that time, I, you know, decided to quit my job there and buy a nicer camera and, you know, kind of just kept following them from there.
John, you lived in Wood Street for 10 years, and the film is mostly told through your experience and another organizer, Lamonte Ford, and you ran a resource center on the ground. There's a scene where y'all were eating gumbo. Somebody was cooking a pot of gumbo. The vegetables and the fruit that you all had there, and you had supplies, you had a shower. This is not the Wood Street that we saw in the news. How would you describe this community and why was it worth fighting for?
Oh my God, it was beautiful. Describing this community, I would just call it very loving, inviting. You know, we never turned anybody away. I'd like to say this to sort of like paint a little picture. We lived at a specific time in history because of COVID. We had a unique opportunity to be able to have time to be able to like grow our community. You know, we were there honestly on Wood Street, a lot of people up to 10 years at the particular lot when we're talking about the Wood Street Commons. We were on that parcel of land for 3 years, but overall we were all in that same space sharing that you know, quarter mile area together for, you know, 0 to 8 years, 10 years. And it gave us time to like really start organizing and getting to know each other and be able to mesh with one another. It was a time where it was possible for us to do what we did. Nowadays, people are getting evicted, every week, every 2 weeks, every month. So it's a lot different than it was back then. And I think that's one of the big, I think that's something that people don't realize right now is that we had time to do what we did. And now people don't get that opportunity to be able to organize and build on their community and experiment and try things out, you know?
And correct me if I'm wrong. I might have been wrong. So correct my language. So did this, okay, because there was a Supreme Court ruling that basically criminalized homelessness. And then there was some stuff with the state and the city. So, because I know I said the city evicted you all. Is it the state? Is it the city? What's the right language to use?
Yeah, it's a little, I was just going to say, it's a little confusing. It started with the state of California, Caltrans. Part of the encampment was on Caltrans land,
right.
Because it was a really large encampment that spanned, you know, maybe a mile, maybe a little less, but covered a bunch of different pieces of land, some railroad land, state of California, the city of Oakland. So the Wood Street Commons, where John lived and where the most of the film is focused, was on the city land. So it started with an eviction by Caltrans, the state of California, and ended with an eviction by the city of Oakland. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for explaining that. Now, John, I'm a journalist like Karen. And one thing I would not let somebody do is follow me around with a camera. but you did. So what was it like? Like, you know, you had to trust Karen. So what made you trust her to, especially too, because Wood Street was so controversial and such a sensitive topic. Why did you trust her to tell your story? And what was it like to have that camera?
Karen was around, you know, for a little while doing small little interviews and reporting back to the San Francisco Chronicle and stuff. And so she was a sort of a familiar face. I don't know, when Karen came back and sort of just told us that she had quit her job and was going to follow us around and do a documentary, we're like, sort of like, oh, okay, yeah, you know, didn't really, you know, really understand what that really meant. But what I can remember is that it was an opportunity I felt to be able to get our story out, mm-hmm. because, you know, like the news show, they always show just the trash and, you know, all the plight and just the negative part of our existence. And this was an opportunity I felt like for people to see the inside story of us, you know, for us to be able to like change that narrative of what people thought about us and to show people like the stuff that we did every day. And I always say this, like, it was just normal stuff that everybody does every day to survive. It doesn't matter if you're housed or unhoused, but I just felt it was a good opportunity. It was an opportunity for us to like just change the narrative and get our story out there. So it was
cause you were like, it was so real. I mean, it's a documentary, but the emotions were raw and then too, the emotions too were sweet. I mean, it was just, you just saw so much, just of people's experiences and how people related to each other. What was it like for you, Karen, someone who is housed, going into a community of people who are unhoused? What was that like for you?
That's a good question. I mean, I think what really drew me in was like, I mean, one, there were already so many housed advocates at Wood Street. That's also one thing that makes it unique. Like so many people went there to volunteer. Wood Street threw parties inviting housed neighbors to come. Like Wood Street was like very, I mean, despite all of the negative talk about it, Wood Street folks were very inviting to their neighbors. And I took advantage of that and used that as an opportunity to meet people. And so I was like, oh, this is like a cool community and they're doing things themselves and building it from the ground up. It wasn't particularly scary to me. It wasn't particularly like it just felt normal and like a good, I don't know. It felt like I was where I was supposed to be. Yeah.
And you've made friends with folks from there, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So again, I learned so much from this documentary. So Wood Street grew in part because the police initially were telling unhoused people to go there. I didn't know about that.
Yeah, I'll just say a good 15 years ago, The city of Oakland administration, I guess, directed the Oakland Police Department to start directing unhoused people to go down to Wood Street to this, unincorporated area where there's nothing really out there except for the train tracks and, a field on the side of the freeway. And so there was this, like, over the 3 year span, there was like this great migration of unhoused people that just came down there and just set up shop down there. And honestly, we weren't really, we were left alone. We weren't bothered,
Yeah, I had no idea when I saw that. So I was like, oh, they were telling people to go there, and I imagine that led to the growth of it. And you said this started 15 years ago. So how old is Wood Street then? What, 15, 20 years or what?
You mean the community of Wood Street out there?
Yeah, or just like as that campus started to grow.
I would say a solid good 10 years for the record is Wood Street's existence. People trickled down there, and it wasn't a lot, and it was more scattered. When we all started concentrating, we were all sort of in this quarter mile stretch of Wood Street. And then later on, people started moving to the back onto the Caltrans land under the freeway. And so it was like 220 yards thick and about a quarter mile length from one end to the next end, and then around the surrounding neighborhoods and stuff. I mean, it was a real community. That's what people didn't really realize. You have all these people in one space, and what do you expect them to do? You know what I mean? So they formed communities. I mean, we had little sub areas. There was Cobb on Wood in the back. There was a Wood Street Commons, and there was like we call it the Target area up north and stuff. So there's like different neighborhoods with, different vibes going on and stuff.
So, and your house, John, do you miss it?
Yes, I do. I miss that community. I miss being able to, like, go out my little front door of my trailer. And even if I didn't really want to speak to anybody, I could always go out, go to the bathroom and just sort of see people outside. I mean, our fire pit was going 24 hours a day. So you could go out 3 o'clock in the morning, there's fire pit going, people around the fire pit. Our community had a bunch of different living rooms and spaces where people could crash out. We had our community kitchen, so people could come 24 hours a day. And if they needed groceries to go back to where they were living, or they could check and see what we might have cooked that day, what was donated and stuff. We had a clothing closet there so people can get fresh clothes. We even had a solar shower at one time at the front area. So it was, I miss that a lot though. I can't do that now. I can't just walk out at 3 o'clock in the morning and go bang on somebody's door and be like, hey,
No,
and then,
you can't do
next door.
that now. No, you can't do that now. Yeah, it's different too, because like you're living somewhere, maybe everybody doesn't know you, and that things of that nature. But so, okay, so the plan, I understand, for the when the city shut it down, was that the city was going to move people to a nearby lot and with tiny houses. And I've been in a tiny house, that they are tiny. And you all, John, you all objected to that. So what did, now I know some folks were thinking, y'all don't have a home, quote unquote home, however you want to define home. So why didn't y'all just go with what the city wanted? I know that came up in the documentary. What did you guys want? What did you want the city to do?
We want to be able to stay at that lot and continue on growing and continue on evolving and continue on building and supporting each other and supporting the rest of the unhoused community in West Oakland, and for that matter, wherever they were at. But we want to really stay at that lot and show them like how organized we really were if they just give us opportunity and stop pushing on us like they did. Yeah, we want to stay there. But when that opportunity came, the you can see in the movie, like I moved into the cabins and I wanted others to go to the cabins. And it wasn't because I thought the cabins were great or anything like that. I was trying to find a way to keep our community together because after getting evicted, people are going to scatter. They're going to be, loose everywhere. And they're not just not going to have that resource of having the community in one space where you can rely on them. You can, lean on them when you need support and stuff. And at that time, the only real way that I saw being able to keep the community together was just like, let's all move there, continue on doing the work that we're doing, in this one space together.
One of the most powerful scenes in the film takes place at a community meeting. And, there were issues at Wood Street, just like any community, right? So I know there was allegations of theft. There were fires, and so there was a meeting with the Oakland Fire Police Chief and Wood Street residents and people who are housed living in the surrounding neighborhoods. And in this clip, we see a woman alleging someone from Wood Street breaking into an empty house next to her and setting on fire or causing a fire. And she and Wood Street organizer Lamonte Ford got into a very heated argument, and that ends in an emotional embrace. This was such a powerful scene. It was many powerful scenes in the film, but this one really was really, really powerful too. So let's listen to that clip.
When that house was vacant, one of your buddies from Wood Street stole some property.
Excuse me, I don't think you know that's the truth.
No, it is. It is.
How do you know that?
We have it on tape.
Show me the video. Oh, it's not us. You don't have anything that I want.
You want us to help you. You gotta help us.
Do you know that we do help you?
How?
We go around. If I see somebody touching your house, or your property?
You haven't done it.
I do it. I do it every day. I just did it for I just did it for the condos over there. I got in trouble for doing it.
I don't want to fight with you.
I don't want to fight either. I just want. I'm passionate too.
Baby, stop.
He's not
stop. Stop. Okay. But it is one of you. It is one of you, okay? I'm not saying it's you.
You're pushing us to where?
No,
where we gonna go? How we gonna live?
We're trying to help y'all.
You guys are killing us.
Oh, man, they're killing us too.
Ooh, that scene gives me chills. That's from the documentary Wood Street. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Karen Creighton. She's an award-winning journalist and the filmmaker behind the documentary Wood Street. The film is about the community and resistance of residents who were evicted from the West Oakland unhoused encampment. And John Janosko was one of the key organizers of Wood Street. He's featured in the documentary. See, I'm stumbling because it was that moved me. That scene moved me. He's featured in the documentary. And Karen... Whoo, that clip shows how complex that issue is in a really interesting way. Why did you include that scene? I almost cried when I watched that.
Yeah, I'll say honestly, when I edited that scene, I don't think I really understood all of the nuances within it. I think it took me to have other people watching it and reflecting back to me to really dig into that. When I cut the scene, I knew it was very powerful. I knew there was something there. Mm-hmm. And it was actually one of the first scenes that I edited of the film. And it really kind of remained almost the same the whole time. I was there that day with Monte filming, and it was just such a very intense and powerful day, a West Oakland community meeting with all of these different emotions and opinions. And it just felt really emblematic of how the homelessness issue is discussed in Oakland,
yeah.
And how housing is discussed in Oakland. And that really, that scene really pinned it down for me.
Yeah. John, what was your reaction to that scene? Or what are your thoughts?
It just brings back memories of just like, you know, what we had to go through, what we went through. Very emotional, because I'm starting to get emotional too with that, because that was a really intense scene. You know, I wasn't actually there that day when that happened, but seeing it on the screen, and just knowing, like, you know, how that young lady feels because of what she thinks. And then, like, you know, my brother Monty and how he feels. And we're trying to change that narrative and stuff. It just brings back it's just very emotional for me, honestly.
Yeah.
It's intense.
Yeah, it is. It is intense. And it kind of goes back. You know, people keep having this question, like, what do we do? Like, how do we fix this? And I felt that's kind of what that scene reflected. So, Karen, what has been the reaction from Wood Street residents to this film?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like most folks are pretty happy. I mean, you can't please everybody, but I think for me, it's been really validating to see that a lot of folks are happy to see their story reflected in a way that validates them, and happy to have their voices uplifted and you know, my goal is just to get as many people as possible to see the film and hopefully to have Wood Street folks there for at least all of our local screenings to help, you know, share the rest of the story. Like the film is, you know, it's one little lens into the Wood Street story. I think one thing I constantly hear from Wood Street residents is that it's not the whole story because the whole story is huge.
Right.
And so I think having Wood Street folks there to tell the rest of it is always really important.
And I just want to say that this is your debut documentary. This is you're selling out theaters. We have about a minute and a half left. So John, some of y'all from Wood Street started a nonprofit called Wood Street Commons. Tell us about the nonprofit, and does it still carry the spirit of the Wood Street community?
Oh, it sure does. So like when we got evicted, we wanted to continue on doing what we're doing for our community. And so it was like, we're just going to make this mobile. So we went and got ourselves a community van. And so now we'll plan out for like 3 Sundays in a row. We go to a different encampment in Oakland. We barbecue. We bring hot food. We bring groceries from go grocery shopping from donations that we get. We give Monty gives free haircuts. We bring harm reduction supplies. We play music. We're starting to play bingo now at the encampments with the residents and giving them cash prizes. It's amazing. So we're able to continue on building our community, staying in touch with everybody, you know, helping guide people, create new leadership, you know, just uplifting. But main thing is just being with our people. You know what I mean? Like we didn't want to like just disappear. And those are who the people that we went through so much with, and we know what they're fighting out there and stuff. So and we know how hard it is. So we just want to continue on doing the work that we're doing. And it's amazing, honestly. We have so much fun out there with people. It's amazing.
Well, thank you both for this film. I really encourage people to watch it. I learned so much. And like I said, John, I know that's not easy to have somebody follow you with the camera. And Karen, I know too that, you know, that work, that's emotional work because it was some really heartbreaking scenes, especially when you see the eviction. But it gives hope too as well too. So thank you both so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Janae.
Karen Creighton is an award-winning journalist and documentarian. John Janosco is an organizer associated with the Wood Street Commons in Oakland. Definitely go see the film Wood Street at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland on Wednesday, July 15th. Very powerful. Coming up, the movie Fairyland is based on a true story set in San Francisco, and I chat with the filmmaker who's also from the Bay. Stay with us. You're listening to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden, on KALW 91.7 FM. The movie Fairyland is about a complicated, loving relationship between a father and daughter. It's a film adaptation of the memoir by Alicia Abbott. Poet Steve Abbott and his young daughter move across the country to San Francisco after his wife is killed in a car accident. He comes to the Bay Area in part to live as an openly gay man. And the father and daughter relationship grows stronger when Alicia returns home from college to care for her dad because he contracted the AIDS virus. The movie begins in the 1970s, and in this clip, actor Scoot McNairy, who plays Steve, talks about his big move with his mother-in-law, played by Gina Davis.
So, California.
I know a few people out there in San Francisco, and I thought I could get more work as a writer.
Have you given any more thought to Janet's offer to raise Alicia? Alicia gets along well with her cousins. She's still young, you know. It's not too late for her to have a real family.
She has a real family, Anne.
You know what I mean.
And my apologies, it's Alicia Abbott. Andrew Durham wrote and directed Fairyland. He is originally from Palo Alto. Sofia Coppola is one of the film's producers. And what's really uncanny is that Andrew and Alicia Abbott had similar experiences with their fathers. And it was around the same era, too, as well. I spoke with Andrew in 2025 about these parallels and how he felt making his first film. Andrew Durham, welcome.
Thank you, Janae, for having me. I'm super happy to be here.
I am so excited to talk to you for so many reasons, and I cannot wait to dig into this conversation. And first of all, congratulations. This is your directorial debut, Andrew. That's a big deal.
Yeah, it is. It's long in the making. As I was a student filmmaker, I went to film school, and before that I made movies as a little kid, but I always knew I wanted to work in the movie business. It just took a while for me to find exactly what I wanted to do in it and then also find the right story to tell. So I'm super excited that I have this story to tell and this is my first film.
Yeah, and you've worked as a producer. You've worked in, you know, so many different roles in film, behind the scenes. You're a photographer. You are an artist.
either that or I'm, you know, I have a short attention span.
And you are from the Bay.
Yes, I grew up down on the peninsula in Palo Alto. And that's where I went to high school. And then I graduated and moved down to Los Angeles to go to film school. But my roots are deeply in the Bay Area.
Yeah. And so the film takes place in the 1970s and 80s, and which is around the time you were living up here in the Bay. I know you're based in L.A. now. What was it like growing up in Palo Alto back then?
I think that being a college town, specifically Palo Alto, was a fantastic place as a young person because it seemed so diverse and it seemed so filled with opportunities. And there were so many different things going on, considering it was a suburb. You know, I think Stanford just being there added a very certain type of energy. And so back in the 70s and 80s, before a lot of the tech invasion happened, and it was a really unique place. We had all of those regular things that kids in the suburb have, you know. Then there was also this element that was so cool, especially as a teenager. We had a lot of revival movie theaters, you know, that would show old films, or art houses that showed foreign films, independent films. Like, they were every few blocks. And so having access to those kind of movies, you know, I think really shaped my language a little bit as a filmmaker, seeing a lot of foreign films and independent films at such a young age. I mean, we would have to actually either get on the bus or get our parents to drive us to Mountain View or Redwood City if we wanted to see a blockbuster, like a big movie, you know, Jaws or Star Wars or something. We had to leave town. Otherwise, we were all watching, you know, Harold and Maude.
So I want to talk about Fairyland. Tell me how you got connected to the book and this project.
The book was actually sent to a dear friend of mine and producer on the film, Sofia Coppola, who I've known for 30 something years. We've kind of grown up together as young artists in Los Angeles. We met in the early 90s and we made a lot of, you know, we made short films together. We did art projects together. And she was sent the book by Alicia Abbott's publisher as a possible person to adapt the memoir into a screenplay and direct the film. Alicia Abbott, the author of the memoir, is a huge fan of Sophia's work and thought Sophia would be perfect for this. And Sophia and I share a lot of, you know, when she's thinking about ideas for movies or I'm thinking about ideas for different things, we share our thoughts. And she sent me the book and said, you know, I've got this book. It came to me. I was really captivated by the photograph on the cover of this little girl and her father taken in Golden Gate Park. And the story is so beautiful, but I just don't know whether it's my story to tell. Sophia knew that I also grew up with a gay father. And when my parents got divorced and my dad moved to San Francisco, my brother and I would spend a lot of our time with my dad and all his friends in the city. And so much in the memoir is about Alicia sort of navigating this balancing act between, you know, her friends at school and then her dad and all his friends. And I really related to that. And Sophia thought I could relate to that. And also, you know, when the AIDS crisis hit San Francisco, I was in the middle of that. I had to, you know, I sort of dropped my life and moved up to the city to take care of my father during the last year of his life. And both my father and Alicia Abbott's father, Steve Abbott, died in 1992. And I just think that having those shared experiences made Sophia realize that perhaps I would be a better person to tell this story, just coming to it with some real personal experiences and right, some honesty about the situation. So
that's amazing that your stories were so parallel. And it's funny, I wonder if your dad and Steve Abbott, if they ever crossed paths.
I know,
paths.
Right? I wondered that too. And it's like, I've sort of gone, I was given a wonderful opportunity from Alicia Abbott to read Steve's journals, which are all in the San Francisco Public Library. And that's what she based her memoir on so much of it, because she was obviously too young to remember the very early years. But I would go through his journals and I would read them line by line to try and figure out, oh, was he ever in the same circle as my dad? Were there any way that these paths would cross? I mean, there were thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of gay men that migrated to San Francisco in the 70s during the gay lib movement. So who knows if their paths ever crossed, but part of me is hoping that they'd had a conversation at a bar one night or something, or at a party. That would be amazing. They're roughly the same age and they were both in the city, different sort of worlds. My dad was an art dealer and a museum curator, and he probably didn't hang out so much in sort of the hippie poet world of the Haight-Ashbury as much, but I still hope mm-hmm. that their paths cross, because San Francisco back then was a pretty diverse place and it was an intersection for a lot of different types of people. I remember as a kid going to parties with my dad and seeing the mix of all these grown-ups, you know, and all these different types of people, from the, you know, the hippies of the Haight-Ashbury to the gay men of the Castro to the blue-blooded high society people of Nob Hill. You know, they were all commingling. So it was kind of fascinating to see that. So maybe, you never know.
Now, did Alicia Abbott, did she write the screenplay with you?
No, I wrote it by myself. It was the first screenplay I had written, and obviously the first book I'd ever adapted into a screenplay. So she had the trust in me to do that, which was pretty amazing. You know, when Sophia and I went out to meet Alicia in Boston and convince her that I should direct this film and not Sophia, at first I think she was a little apprehensive, but then when she heard about our similar histories, I think she was quite comfortable, and then she said, all right, do it, go for it.
If you're just tuning in, I'm chatting with director Andrew Durham. His film is Fairyland. Let's actually just talk about these characters and these people. And the relationship. So actors Emilia Jones and Scoot McNairy, they play father and daughter, or daughter and father, Alicia and Steve. They were really great on screen. And so Alicia and Steve's relationship is so complex. And as I was watching, part of me understood why, you know, he wanted to move across the country to San Francisco and live his openly gay life. And on the other hand, a part of me found him selfish and irresponsible, because sometimes he put men and partying in his writing before his daughter. He did drugs around her, but he took care of her. He raised her. He could have left her with her grandparents. And you mentioned this earlier about just some of the issues and the feelings that come up. You maybe share some sentiments about your relationship with your father. And I'm seeing the same thing with Alicia and Steve. What are your thoughts on their relationship and how it's conveyed in this film?
What I love about the memoir is she brings all of these issues up, but there's never once any sort of judgment in her writing. And that really resonated with me. And I think that was what I was excited about trying to do in this film, is to sort of share these situations as honestly as possible, bringing in some of my own thoughts on this, which I'll talk about in a second, but making sure that nothing was black or white, that it was like, I was trying to make this thing so sort of non-binary when it comes to human situations, because we have a tendency in literature and film and storytelling to make sure that we have a good and a bad, a right and a wrong, you know, there's got to be somebody evil. And I remember actually when I was sort of taking the script around and trying to get investors and financing and people like that interested in studios, a common note was he's not a good enough parent. You need a very positive role model for gay parenting. He's too flawed. So that was one big note I got. The other note was the grandmother's not mean enough. She needs to be a villain. We really need to see her trying to take the kid away, and we need to see Steve be a great parent and prove her wrong. And so these were very sort of, I don't know, predictable notes to me. I think we've seen this kind of narrative before. I mean, I'm glad that people want to show positive queer role models. I think that's great. But that was not necessarily the story that Alicia Abbott was telling. Hers was a little bit more complicated, and hers seemed more based in reality to me. And now that the film is out and people are seeing it, it's so nice to have people come up and say, thank you so much for making the grandmother not a villain. That's just showing that she actually really loved her daughter and she was going to be patient and she had concerns like they would be, but you didn't take sort of the typical easy target route with her. And thank you for showing a parent who messes up and then tries to, you know, correct themselves. But, and thank you for showing a teenager who is also flawed, who makes mistakes and who says terrible things that teenagers do, and that teenagers aren't always right, you know. Right. All sorts of across the spectrum of different things that I'm so glad that we stuck with. And one thing I kind of wanted to address, Janae, is that you touched on a little bit there about Steve and his sort of flamboyant lifestyle and his drug use. And I've talked about this with a few other people in some interviews, but I understood this much later in life, which I didn't really get when I was a kid. But my dad and so many guys that sort of grew up in the 50s that came out in the 1970s, they grew up in very sort of, well, the country was a different place than obviously. It was the 1950s and they were all very closeted and they were all very suppressed. And they did not have that kind of natural adolescence that so many of their peers were going through during junior high and high school. And so they sort of had a false adolescence and they suppressed so much of that, you know? And it wasn't until they were sort of embraced in the gay lib movement in cities like New York City or Los Angeles or San Francisco in the 1970s that they were able to actually come out and live an honest sort of adolescence, for lack of, I keep repeating this word, but you know, that sort of coming of age. And that's what I loved in the book too, was it shared this parallel coming of age story. So right as Alicia was sort of growing up and coming into her own, so was her father, because he wasn't able to do that at such a young age. And I remember as a kid visiting my dad and his friends, and you know, and they were wild and they were partying kind of like my friends were partying in high school. And I was like, huh, look at this. And they're going out late at night and they're dancing and they're having all this fun. And I was like, I don't think I understood the term arrested development back then, but I definitely was aware that something was going on. And then I realized, like, you know what, they're finally able to go through something that they weren't able to do when they were younger.
You know, later on, there's a scene where Steve asks his daughter if he's been a good father. Let's hear a clip of that.
Do you think I was a good parent?
Yeah, of course you were. You are. Why would you ask that?
I worry that you questioned some of the choices I made. Look, I didn't really know how to be a single parent. I just didn't want you to be raised the way that I was raised. My childhood was a series of boundaries and punishments. That kind of thing can really cripple a person. So, if I was sometimes a failure as a parent, just know that these were noble failures and that I always tried to do what was right for you.
You know, Andrew, I'm thinking about what you said earlier. Steve and your dad wilded out to live more freely, maybe didn't make the best choices, but it was the right choices, what they knew at the time. And I was just thinking about that Maya Angelou quote, you know, when you know better, you do better. And also too, I was also thinking about how this all goes back to, for many parents, that, you know, they're just doing the best they can.
Yeah. I mean, when my parents got divorced and my father moved to San Francisco, we stayed down in the suburbs with my mom. So it wasn't the exact or situation that Alicia had, that she was raised by her single dad, but my brother and I were raised by our single mom. And she was somebody who thought she was going to get married. She was gonna have kids. She was gonna have a husband who supported her. My mother also a product of the 50s. This is what mm-hmm. was supposed to happen. And then all of a sudden her husband comes out of the closet and moves away, and she's left with two kids, and he's not only sort of like finding himself emotionally and sexually and all of that, but he's also reinventing himself. Sort of, he was an accountant, he quit all that and wanted to work in the arts in San Francisco and be an art dealer and an antique dealer and all of this stuff. So he was kind of starting from scratch there. So it wasn't like my mom could really rely on him for much financial support. Like, he was figuring it out. It was almost like relying on a college, your kid going, graduating college and expecting them to support you. No, they're just going to figure out what they're doing. So they do the best they can do. And a theme that I hope people get out of this movie is that there's more than one type of good parent. For I'm not a parent, but I have a lot of friends that are raising their kids, and they get stuck sometimes in this frame of mind that, well, to be a good parent, you have to check off certain boxes.
Right.
But you don't.
I mean, and that's interesting too, what you just said, because I'm thinking about the expectations, right? What are the expectations? I'm thinking of both of them. They were dealing with the societal expectations of how they're supposed to be. You know, Alicia's dealing with how she's supposed to be as a girl, how her hair is supposed to look, because he couldn't do her hair, right? But he did the best he can. How was he expected to be as a man, right? I'm sure he was carrying that. And like these expectations of how people are supposed to be. And that's why I really like the film, because people didn't fit in a box. Like you said, it wasn't black or white. It was gray. There doesn't always have to be a villain. I mean, people are complex. That's why I said sometimes I was like critical of him, of Steve, but I also had compassion, and for Alicia too, because I was critical of Alicia too. And it's funny because Alicia sometimes was selfish, right? As when she was younger, she was selfish. She was ashamed. There was a time she was ashamed of her father being gay because of his expectations of what she thought a home was supposed to be, a family was supposed to be, and the peer pressures from friends who were homophobic. So it's really, I just like films like that where it just really shows just how layered it is to be human. And it's not cut and dry fairy tale. I know this is fairy land, but it's not cut and dry, you know, fairy tale, good, bad. It's, you know, it's in between. It's people being human. If you're just tuning in, I'm chatting with director Andrew Durham. His film is Fairyland. So you shot some of this film in San Francisco. And I know you, like, again, you have worked behind the scenes on different films. What is it like shooting in San Francisco? Like, what's unique about it?
San Francisco is as much of a character in this story as Steve and Alicia are. So,
absolutely.
I have a fabulous local producer, Megan Carlson, who lives in San Francisco, and she really figured out a way for us to do this. And, you know, we also had a very tight budget. So we had to think economically of how we were going to do this. So the film, we shot in the city proper only 2 days. And then the next day we shot everything we needed to do in Golden Gate Park. All the interiors that you see were actually shot right across the bay in Vallejo. Vallejo is a wonderful little town, and it was, you know, sort of built around the same time San Francisco was. So there's a lot of the similar architecture. And in Vallejo, there is a place called Mare Island, which is an old military base.
Yeah.
And on that military base, there are several abandoned, well, some aren't abandoned, some have companies in them, and I think one even has a wine tasting room in them. But they're these old Navy captain mansions, again, built around the same time as a lot of the row houses in San Francisco. And we just, or Megan found these and thought, well, why don't we shoot our interior apartment scenes in one of these old mansions? Oh, I love Vallejo. Shoot in Vallejo. If anyone out there wants a great place to shoot, it's a really wonderful community, and it's got all sorts of great resources and wonderful location. So,
yeah, because I thought it was still San Francisco. So you fooled me. Okay, so Andrew, again, this is such an amazing film. This is your you know, directorial debut. You wrote the screenplay. You adapted it from a book. I know that was not easy. And for your first film, you directed Gina Davis.
All right.
Oh my awesome. Gosh. Yes.
I've always been a huge fan of Gina Davis. She's just one of those actors who just always stuck with me. And I don't think there's really been anyone quite like her since. You know, from the first time I saw her in Tootsie, just to everything she's done afterwards, and there's just something so cool about her. And it was one of those whims where, you know, you've got this script, you're trying to attach actors, and I just said to some, we have a wonderful casting team. I said, can we just send the script to her? Just, you know, why not? What do I got to lose? I mean, what's going to happen? And she read it. Apparently she liked it, because then I got a call from like her people and they said, well, how many days do you need her for? And I was like, and I'm like thinking, oh my God, this is going to happen. I bet I can do it. So I said, one, could she just fly up to San Francisco and we'll do it all in one day? And so we did it that way. And she said, yes. And so she, the script must have resonated with her and she liked it. And, you know, she has a wonderful foundation about gender equality in media. If nobody knows about, they should look that up, because it's all about making sure that just as many female voices and characters are represented, especially in children's stories, as there are boys. So I really have been impressed by that, and I really respect that. So that was another reason why I was like, you know what, I got to get this lady on board. So I said I could do it in one day, and she flew up, and she was such a good sport. So we shot all of her scenes in one day. You know, and you watch the film, and you think, well, she was just on the phone, but really, there were some big scenes. You know, she had that.
I mean, how many people can say that the first movie they directed had Gina Davis?
Cool,
in it?
Right?
So, I mean, just to let folks know, Gina Davis plays Alicia's grandmother, Steve's mother-in-law. I mean, so to just kind of play it down like, oh, she was, you know, she was on the phone. She was doing more than on the phone. But I think if I directed a movie and Gina Davis was in it, I don't care if she just,
I know, right? Just
if she just said hello and hung up.
Right? No,
I had Gina Davis in my first film.
We were really lucky about that. And again, I think it goes back to Alicia Abbott's story. I think she wrote a beautiful memoir, and it's a story that resonates with people. It was the same with Adam Lambert. You know, he's like,
yeah, I was going to ask about that, because he plays Steve's boyfriend, and I did not recognize him at all. I did not recognize him at all at first. And this was his first dramatic role, right?
His first movie. And again, this was somebody who, you know, he was in the middle of like touring with Queen, and this was another situation. I need you for, I think, like a day. Can you come in and do all this in a day? And the story resonated with him. He also has childhood memories of relatives that lived in the Castro in San Francisco, and he would spend time there, and has really colorful memories of that whole era. And so he wanted to be a part of it. He's so good in it too. He comes in with such heart. He just rolled in, and the chemistry he had with Scoot was like a home run for me. And so I was really happy to have.
You know, something I didn't mention is grief, right? Because there's grief with Steve of losing his wife, and Alicia losing her mother. And then there's also grief too, because he has AIDS. So there's grief in there. And how does that drive their lives and maybe some of their actions too? And that's another reason why you may judge Steve, but also too, there's this compassion too, because he is grieving. So how does that drive Alicia's and Steve's lives and their relationship?
A great question. You know, I've done so many interviews for this film, and that topic, even though that seems to be an underlying theme in the film as it was in the memoir, but it's something that hasn't really been asked. I think that grief obviously is about loss. And so, you know, when you're grieving someone, you're mourning the loss of somebody, but you're also addressing just loss and life and the shortness of life. And which I think for me, whether it's consciously or subconsciously, it then reverts back to living life to the fullest. And you can look at Steve, you know, losing his wife and realizing how fragile life is. And perhaps when you're confronted with that, how you need to embrace life more than ever. I think that when my father got, my own father got sick, you know, I was just in my 20s when my dad died. it was a kind of a wake-up call for me. And I think that grief manifested in really pursuing my dreams more than ever and really living large more than ever. And that's sometimes a weird gift you get from close ones that pass, is that they're a reminder that you're not going to be around forever and you need to really step up your game and really live life and not put stuff off. You know, in the story, Alicia Abbott decides she wants to go to France to study abroad. And this is something her father had always wanted for her. When you read the memoir, you understand a little bit that she kind of saw what was coming down the pike a little bit with her dad. We touch on this a little bit in the film. She comes home from college and she sees the obituaries in the newspaper. Yeah. She sees the young man sick in the hospice. It's like, you know, maybe it seems selfish to leave and embrace this dream she has when it's possible this could be happening to her father, but also it's a reminder, live life.
Well, Andrew, for your first film, you did a great job, and I hope you make more movies, because if this is your first film, I can only imagine what you got cooking.
Thank you for the words of acknowledgement and inspiration, and you reminded me to get back to writing. So,
thank you so much, Andrew, for your time.
Thank you, Janae. It was just a real pleasure.
Andrew Durham is the director of the film Fairyland, and you can stream it on various platforms. Such a good movie. This interview originally aired in 2025. And that's all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds show with me, Janae Darton. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rangel, and our board operator, Tarek Ansari. And thank you for tuning in. You know, a couple of poets I know passed away this past week, and I'm going to give a tribute to them in the coming weeks. So just a reminder, just to take care of your people. And these people passed away very, very young. They were in their 50s and 40s. So just take care of each other. Really, really take care of each other. Look out for each other. Folks are going through a lot. Well, with that, we'll have another great show for you right here next Wednesday at 4 p.m. And until then, be good to yourselves and be good to each other.